What's the water-rich and planetary environment that they love to ignore? Let's call it Earth.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Fred Williams.
And I'm Doug McBurney. Fred, the hydroplate theory and the global flood are back in the news. Just last week, various science news outlets reported a possible saltwater world, Fred. And I'm suspecting you already have a particular saltwater world in mind when you hear that.
Yeah, let's call it Earth. As Kevin Lee loves to say. So, well, here's the headline from Science News. The 2024 New Jersey meteorite contains amino acids. But that headline leaves out what may be the most interesting part, Doug, and that this space rock also contains evidence that it was altered by concentrated salty water or brine. And I'll say a rock that came from space, but where did it originate?
Oh, so wait a minute. This meteorite just didn't have like tiny little bits of water molecules locked inside a mineral?
No. So the researchers found sodium-rich material that they suggested was concentrated salty fluids that had moved through or chemically altered the rock. The scientific paper itself is called Meteor Over New York City, Brines in a Primitive CM Asteroid. So we have a meteorite containing organic matter, a diverse collection of amino acids, and evidence of chemistry involving concentrated salt water. So let me repeat that, Doug, salt water. And what does the hydroplate theory propose, Doug?
Hydroplate theory proposes that asteroids, meteoroids, comets are fragments of Earth, some that blasted into space, launched at over 7 miles a second, Fred, during the eruption of the fountains of the Great Deep. According to hydroplate theory, enormous quantities of subterranean water erupted violently from beneath the Earth's crust during the global flood. Some material actually escaped the Earth and entered orbit around the Sun. Under the model, we expect to find materials associated with Earth in at least some asteroids and meteorites. Fred, we should expect to find water, lots of water, salt, rock altered by liquid water, organic material, and maybe even biological or biochemical compounds carried along with the ejected material. And so, boom, right there in New Jersey, this meteorite with brine-altered minerals, organic compounds, and amino acids. That doesn't sound like a dry rock that simply condensed out of a slowly rotating hot cloud of gas.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like their standard go-to story. So, Doug, here's the actual account. So on July 16th, 2024, just a little over a year ago, a daytime meteor streaked over the New York metropolitan area, creating a sonic boom. Researchers estimate that the original object weighed about 100 pounds and entered the atmosphere at about 8 miles per second. It broke apart, and a 3-pound fragment crashed through the roof of a house in Hillsboro, New Jersey. Now, this was reported in Smithsonian Magazine. The homeowner said, "I heard an immense crash and felt the house shake." He then went to the master bedroom and noticed that there was a hole in the ceiling above my bed. So, and you know, the crime scene of this whole meteorite crashing through his ceiling, it smelled like rotten eggs and it was covered in black soot. Scattered about were several dark rocks, fragments of a meteorite. So together, the recovered pieces formed a roughly 3-pound object dubbed the Hillsboro meteorite.
That's right. Hillsboro, New Jersey. And Hillsboro's got to love that they've got a meteorite named after them. I mean, a lot of towns in New Jersey, it doesn't go that well for them. So that's really good for Hillsboro. We're glad nobody was hurt. And Fred, it's a great way to get someone else to clean up your room, right? You have a mineral sample delivered from space. Hey, get some college kids in here and clean up my room.
Yeah, you know, the cleaning service probably is might be cheap, but man, the roof repair might be a little costly for that guy.
Yeah.
But, you know, he probably likes the fame, you know. By the way, this happened around 11:15 a.m. So I got to thinking, what if the person who was living in that house, Doug, and it's 11:15 a.m., what if that person was a pothead? I mean, he still would have been in bed. And he would have been toast. That I mean, literally toast.
Yeah, literally toast. Forget toasted. He would have been
Melba toast.
the first known pothead ever taken out by a carbonaceous chondrite. Wow.
Yeah. So, well, seriously, Doug, what makes this specimen unusually valuable is that the homeowner actually handled the pieces carefully. He used gloves and aluminum foil and quickly sealed the fragments in glass jars. And so that greatly reduced the possibility that, you know, the sodium and organic compounds or amino acids came from contamination, you know, after the meteor reached Earth, because there will be a lot that will claim that, you know, this thing was contaminated, those who oppose this viewpoint. So if a pothead had survived this, Doug, and taken the sample, there undoubtedly would have been Cheetos all over it.
Yeah. Well, what's the deal for
that?
Was this guy?
So.
What was this guy like living in New Jersey? Was he just an avid forensic files guy? He knew, like, put on gloves, yeah, plastic, tin foil, make sure that's pretty impressive. Obviously, well, I shouldn't say obviously, but probably not a pothead. This guy was on the ball, right? And
yeah, yeah.
So because he was, scientists can't easily dismiss the salt and all the other stuff as something that this thing picked up after landing. This was a freshly fallen and unusually well-preserved meteorite. And researchers, Fred, have classified this as a rare CM1/2 carbonaceous chondrite. They found fragments rich in sodium compared with similar meteorites. Their conclusion was that concentrated brines had once altered portions of the parent material. And the SETI Institute described the finding as evidence that this material had experienced concentrated salty fluids. And then we come to the amino acids, Fred. The meteorite contained a diverse suite of carbon-bearing compounds, amino acids, and other molecules. And get this, Fred, molecules that secular researchers call prebiotic.
Prebiotic, okay. So, Doug, I think this is where here comes the evolutionary story.
Yeah, right on cue every time, yep. Instead of asking whether this collection of saltwater-altered rock, organic material, and amino acids might have originated, like on a water-rich planet, like maybe Earth, they totally reversed the direction. In other words, they find Earth-like chemistry in space. They don't consider that Earth may have sent the material into space. They argue space sent it to Earth.
It's their paradigm. They will never consider it came from Earth. But let's look at the observed facts, which include a meteorite, sodium-rich material, evidence of concentrated brine, organic compounds, amino acids, water rock chemistry. Those are the observations. But statements about the meteorite coming from a protoplanet that formed beyond Jupiter or helping to seed the early Earth with ingredients of life, those are interpretations based on their secular solar system atheist-based model. And, you know, no scientists watched this object form beyond Jupiter, Doug. No scientists observed salty water flowing through its alleged parent asteroid billions of years ago. And no scientists observed asteroids supplying a barren Earth with the chemicals that eventually produced life. Poof. I mean, that is their reconstruction of the past. That's their fairy tale.
Yeah, yeah. And the hydroplate reconstruction is that this material originated on Earth and was launched into space at the beginning of Noah's flood.
Yeah, exactly. So under the hydroplate theory, discovering saltwater-altered material in meteorites is not, you know, some big surprise for us. It's exactly the kind of evidence we would expect if portions of Earth's crust and upper mantle and subterranean water, salts, and organic material were violently launched into space. And this is not merely a meteorite containing generic water. This is evidence of concentrated I repeat, concentrated salty fluid, Doug. It's inside the rock. That makes the connection to a water-rich planetary environment that much more compelling. And again, what's the water-rich and planetary environment that they love to ignore? Let's call it Earth.
Hello. You know, all those facts, Fred, they also, they turn the usual evolutionary argument around. They say amino acids in a meteorite show that space may have delivered life's ingredients to Earth, but amino acids aren't alive. And even calling them the ingredients of life, Fred, that's deceptive because they're never going to be alive or form a life or graduate or go to college or drive a car. They're not going to have a life. So finding them does not explain where life comes from.
Yeah, so get a life. Yeah, so amino acids are components used in proteins, but merely possessing amino acids, Doug, like letters on a Scrabble board, does not get you anywhere close to a functioning cell, nor does just randomized Scrabble tiles get you phrases in a book and Shakespeare.
Yeah.
So a living organism requires precisely sequenced proteins, genetic information, and that's a key, genetic information, and all this elaborate molecular machinery, membranes, energy processing systems like the mitochondria, coordinated reproduction. I mean, how do you get reproduction in some evolutionary model? So finding amino acids in a meteorite is not evidence that life assembled itself from non-living chemicals. In fact, under the hydroplate model, organic compounds associated with Earth material could have been carried into space during the flood catastrophe, and we have all kinds of evidence for that. So the presence of amino acids may tell us something about the meteorite's history, but it does not demonstrate abiogenesis. Or is it abiogenesis, Doug? You know, tomato,
abio. It's nonsense, so you can pronounce it any way you want, because it's made up. It's made up by men. And like that, like this prebiotic, it's like, what does that even mean? Before life, prebiotic, I can kind of understand the structure of the word, but it's just a made up word like abiogenesis. It's all silliness, Fred. So in fact, abiogenesis, that kind of links it to the Young Frankenstein movie, which I think is a good connection. You remember Abby in Young Frankenstein?
Yeah, it's been a long time, but yeah.
Abby, you know, Abby Normal, that brain. Anyway, so Abby, I'm going to go with abiogenesis from now on, probably just because of that. But anyway, seriously, it just demonstrates, Fred, that when godless scientists find a meteorite that was altered by salty water, contains organic matter, contains amino acid, they're forced by their a priori commitment to materialism to insist it's a clue about how those ingredients came to Earth. Hydroplate theory, on the other hand, asks, did they come from Earth?
This discovery does not, standing alone, prove that the Hillsborough meteorite originated on Earth, but it's strikingly consistent with the hydroplate theory's expectation that meteorites and asteroids should contain water-altered minerals, salts, organic material, and other Earth-like chemical signatures that we keep discovering in space. You know, how many times do we have something in the news that just confirms the hydroplate theory? And it's just, here we have another example. Just this month, Doug, that they're reporting on this. It happened last year, but it's now hitting the news. Finding a meteorite with concentrated saltwater chemistry. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. The hydroplate model invites us to turn their interpretation around. Rather than asking how a space rock brought saltwater chemistry and organic compounds to Earth, I think we should be asked whether this rock originally came from the only saltwater world we know is filled with organic material and amino acids, planet Earth.
Hello. That's right, Fred. And even if take the hydroplate theory off the table, Fred, and just the question you would ask if you didn't have an a priori commitment to something else, the question you would ask would not lead you to start investigating, did this come from space? The natural question is, how could this have possibly come from the only water-rich planet? Yes, it's just a demonstration of the confusion that we're here to help with here on Real Science Radio and over at Hydroplate University, Fred. This reminds me, I'm going to be on the podcast at Hydroplate University with Kevin Lee. We're going to talk about asteroids, meteorites, meteoroids, and the origin of all that stuff. I don't know that we have a broadcast date, but it'll be on the website, on the podcast. I'm pretty stoked about that.
Yeah, that's exciting. In fact, we're going to have Kevin Lee on the show here fairly soon, I think within the next month.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's hptuniversity.com. Go to hptuniversity.com.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They are, that's Hydroplate University. There's going to be active teaching of the hydroplate theory there, and I think you're going to find all kinds of great materials. And, mm-hmm. you know, speaking of the hydroplate theory, Doug, so I was in Chicago last week presenting the best of Real Science Radio to the Midwest Creation Fellowship group out there. And man, what a great organization. They're so well organized. So many great people I met out there. You know, they've got three different places where they meet. One is like really close to the border of Wisconsin, and then all the way down to the southern suburbs of Chicago. And, you know, thank goodness, Doug, it wasn't South Chicago. You know, I'd have felt like the Apostle Paul going in to get stoned somewhere. You know, just, anyways, it turns out their roots, Midwest Creation Fellowship, one of the guys in the first meeting place I went to said that, hey, you know, all of this pretty much started with Dr. Walt Brown. So somehow he's a forerunner to that group. Just like Bob Enyart was a forerunner to our local creation group, Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And speaking of the hydroplate theory, Walt Brown's latest book, the 9th edition, is out. It's shipping all over the world, Doug. We're shipping it from our warehouse, right? And Doug's got an impressive warehouse because you do this for a living. Actually, you have to ship out medical equipment and whatnot. So you can get this book at our store, store.rsr.org, or on Amazon. Now, on Amazon, it's priced about $4 cheaper. Now, why would we sell the book for more than, you know, Amazon? Well, we have a strategy. We prefer you, at least in the beginning, for a while, to buy it off Amazon and then go leave a review, because that'll push the book in the Amazon algorithm to expose the book to more people. So more people may be looking for the, you know, evidence for the global flood or just whatever, just anything related to flood might come across what we think at Real Science Radio is the absolute number one best creation resource ever. And it's not just for the hydroplate theory. This book, as you can see how thick this thing is, it's huge. It's got great material. Just starting out in the book, it's all kinds of really good evidence for creation, evidence against evolution, and it's so well designed and packaged. It's to me, it's my favorite creation book, always has been. It was my favorite creation book before I even really knew much about the hydroplate theory. I kind of skipped those chapters, just like Bob Enyart did. You know, he became a big advocate of hydroplate, but he originally just kind of skipped those chapters later in the book on the hydroplate theory, just because there's so much great content even before you get to that part of the book.
Yeah, well, what I remember because that book sat on Bob's book stack for many years. And what finally compelled Bob was this fellow at the very beginning of his book started with, here's what the Bible says. Let's start there and let's look at what the world looks like and see if what the Bible says can explain anything we see or many things we see. And because he started with that biblical foundation, Bob was compelled to read, and the rest is history, as they say. And by the way, Fred, I think on Amazon, you have to buy the book on Amazon in order to leave a review, if I'm not mistaken, right?
I actually think you can leave a review if you don't buy the book there, but I think the algorithm, you know, favors more the verified reader, the verified buyer of a book. That's my understanding.
Okay.
I could be wrong. So here's just kind of a semi, I don't know if it's a funny story or embarrassing for me. I'm not that embarrassed about it, but I've been banned from leaving reviews on Amazon, Doug.
No way. Yeah. What did you do, Fred?
I was, because I bought some product that was just a piece of junk. I didn't use any bad language. I wasn't, you know, but I think they thought I was being violent because I said, and I'm paraphrasing, but it was almost just like this. I take great pleasure in destroying this device without even sending it back because it's that much of a piece of junk. That got me banned for life. I've even made a couple of appeals, you know, here and there. I hear nothing back, just crickets. So, yeah.
It's yet another example of how the generations coming up, they cannot relate to humor, and they're having a harder and harder time just relating to reality. Like, the reality was you had more fun destroying that product than you would have gotten satisfaction for sending it back for a refund. And that should be amusing. It should also be enlightening and instructive to Amazon and to the manufacturer as to their quality. There's all kinds of good things that happen, but because there was a mention of something that could be perceived as violent, they've built in these algorithms to protect themselves. And I'm telling you, Fred, it's just going to lead to more and more problems, because you have to face reality at some point, kids. I'm just telling you, you have to do it.
Exactly. It's a feminization of society. I mean, Doug, if we were given as little young boys and our parents gave us a Barbie doll, okay, if you're a girl, you dress it up. If they give the Barbie doll to you and me, we're getting our M80s out, our, you know, our firecrackers. We're destroying the thing in different ways, you know. We're doing all kinds of annex to get that thing blown to bits.
Yeah. and that scares everybody now, but it's reality, that's all. It's real. And so, just like this a priori commitment that the godless have to their materialism, that's a fact too. And the way they headline this story, Fred, just proves it.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so Doug, it's now time for the interesting fact of the week. Now, normally we have a sponsor for this segment, but hey, guess what? We didn't have a sponsor this week. So this is a good opportunity to reach out to our audience. We actually need your help, especially now that we're coming up to renew our radio contract. We actually need your help to stay on the radio. We will always continue the show, and we're going to continue on YouTube. We're doing really well there. We're going to continue on Spotify. You can go to our website at any time and listen to the audio. If you're in your car, you can hook up your phone and, you know, listen to our programs. All that's never going to go away as far as we are concerned.
Over but our dead
actually
bodies.
Airing, yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. But to stay on KLTT AM 670 in Denver at 12:30 noontime, you know, over the lunch hour, that takes some, you know, some quite a bit of funds, actually, and we need your help. If you want to continue to hear us on KLTT, we actually need you to help us out here, and we're going to use August, I think, Doug, maybe it's going to be our telethon month, and we need to raise the funds for the radio, and that'll make our decision whether or not we stay on the radio. We'll let that make the decision for us. So please, if you like to hear us on radio, you got to reach out. Tell us, even if you just tell us, hey, I'm listening to you on KLTT. It's the easiest way for me to do it. Please let us know. We need to make sure that it's worth what we're putting into this, the funds that are necessary to keep us on the radio.
That's right. Because while we do have an offer out to Mattel to advertise Barbie on the show, we're not sure that they're going to accept that or the terms that we asked for. So anyway, we could use your help. If you want to keep the show on the radio, if you want to help at all, we could use your help. All right, Fred, so you're going to do this. The interesting fact of the week. I suppose I'm ready.
All right, well, here we go. So I've got a list here to choose from. Let's see which one I'm going to do. Okay, here we go. The interesting fact of the week. Which planet has the shortest day?
Oh, boy. Which planet has the shortest day? Well, it's nice that there's only 8 choices. That helps me.
Yes.
That improves my odds. So the shortest day
would... used to be 9 choices, but now it's 8. Yep.
That's right. And I lean toward that, by the way, Fred. Excluding Pluto, I'm leaning toward Pluto being a trans-Neptunian object and quite possibly related to the hydroplate theory. I'm just leaning that way. No, I haven't made a hard decision.
Okay.
But let me think about... So the longest day would have nothing to do with the orbit of the planet around the sun. It would have to do with the speed that the planet is spinning.
Well, this is the shortest day.
On its orbit. So this would be the fastest spinning planet. That's probably technically not true.
We
could consult an astronomer, because like the surface of Jupiter might actually be moving faster than the surface of Mercury. I don't really know. So I don't want to embarrass myself. The shortest day Ah, boy, Fred. I mean, we know The Longest Day. I mean, that was a movie about D-Day invasion. And then The Longest Day, in reality, The Longest Day would have been the day when there was a battle in the Bible, and I believe it involved Joshua and Moses.
Yeah.
So that's really not helping. I'm stalling for time,
you're stalling,
Fred. So my assistant is working the AI channel over here off camera. No, actually, I'm going without a net on this one. Okay, I think the shortest day. All right, I'm going to exclude Mars. I'm going to exclude Mercury because it's too obvious. Mercury, Venus, Earth, Venus.
You were close earlier when you said the fastest rotating planet. Jupiter completes one rotation in just under 10 hours.
Jupiter, get out!
Jupiter.
Jupiter. Isn't Jupiter the biggest planet?
It is.
How can the biggest planet have the shortest day? That's just counterintuitive, Fred. I need to log a formal complaint. I don't think that question was fair.
The exact is 9 hours and 55 minutes.
No kidding. I would not have guessed that. That would have been like I would have offered Pluto before I would have guessed Jupiter. That's just one more fascinating thing about our amazing solar system that is the handiwork, and it shows the handiwork of God. The heavens declare the glory of God, and like the biggest planet has the shortest day. It's like, are you trying to blow my mind? That's cool.
Okay, so Doug, we've talked about these scientists finding amino acids and this concentrated salt water in a meteorite, which definitely points to hydroplate theory. So I wanted to get to this next headline that astronomers say they found sugar in space between stars. So interstellar space.
That's like the proto Milky Way. Like one of my favorite.
Yeah, there it
candies.
Is, you know. We're already 10 seconds into the story, Doug, and you've already ruined a fine candy bar with a lame joke.
Oh,
yeah,
Fred.
Proto Milky Way. That's good joke, Doug. I got to give you credit for that one.
It's not. It's not that good a joke. But I am just following the evidence.
Okay, so the molecule is called erythrulose. And our listeners and people watching on YouTube, please leave comments on just how badly I pronounce that word. It's a four-carbon sugar found naturally in things like raspberries. And according to the article, it also is used in some self-tanning products, Doug.
Self-tanning. Self-tanning?
Yeah.
So like somewhere near the center of the galaxy, there's a pale molecular cloud that's trying to get ready for summer? Or self-tanning products. That's not suntan lotion. Is that like the orange-colored? I'm not sure what that is, Fred. So we'll look that up, and we'll do a little research on self-tanning products and see if we can connect that to the origin of life. But anyway, go on, Fred. Continue.
Well, it's supposed to be about 26,000 light years away. So, you know, by the time a tan develops, Doug, you know, summer would definitely be over. So.
Now, but this may explain, though, Fred, why astronomers, they spend so much time looking at the center of the Milky Way. They're looking for that perfect tan, like, or maybe they're looking for a sweet snack. Like, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, before our listeners think that astronomers actually found packets of table sugar floating between stars. So what really happened is they detected a spectral signature of a particular molecule in a large molecular cloud near the center of our galaxy. It's an interesting discovery because this particular sugar they found is a genuine sugar molecule with four carbon atoms. So they describe it as the most complex sugar yet conclusively identified in interstellar space.
That's cool. But then, of course, I'm guessing, Fred, right on schedule, the headline writers start connecting it to the origin of life, right?
Yeah, and that's why, I mean, Doug, we could make this arguably the Knucklehead Science Award of the Week.
Yeah.
There's many candidates for this, but it's pretty silly. I don't know how they do that stuff with a straight face. So the reasoning usually goes like this. So life uses complex organic molecules. We found a complex organic molecule in space. Therefore, space chemistry may have helped provide the ingredients from which life arose.
Yes, yes. In fact, Fred, that's almost a textbook example of, I forget the logic of a logical, and not a logical fallacy, not circular reasoning. Anyway, I never went to college, but I do understand logic. And that is a textbook example of, I'm forgetting there's a Latin term for it. So anyway, any of you kids out there who've competed in debate, you probably know what this represents. But it all sounds very impressive, Fred, until you slow it down. Finding a sugar molecule is not the same thing as finding life.
No, not even close. So life obviously requires far more than a collection of some organic chemicals. It requires, first of all, the most important genetic information, but it also requires these precisely constructed proteins that are just thousands of amino acids long. And we talked about this before, molecular machines, energy systems, all of this stuff. Finding one sugar molecule doesn't explain any of that. And it's like finding a skid mark on a desert highway and announcing that you've discovered how automobiles built themselves.
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
right.
Seriously, just the leaps and bounds, Doug, that they go to, the lengths they'll go to push their atheistic theory, but they get to the point of it's just silly.
That's right. And it's like finding a bag of flour and claiming you've solved the mystery of the origin of bakeries. Uh-huh.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, with enough time, heat, and random explosions, the flour will eventually become the Hostess Corporation.
Yeah.
Or, the Milky Way candy bar.
That's right. M&M Mars. And they'll file an IPO, Fred.
Oh, I forgot about the Mars bar.
That's right.
Yeah.
Oops. That's right. They'll file an IPO and it'll all settle on a naturally selected opening stock price.
Yeah, that's right. So
that's a SpaceX reference, Fred. Did you lose any money on that deal? I didn't lose a dime.
Oh, I didn't. I didn't touch it. I had a friend who jumped in on that. And he was smart. He sold it a week after it opened.
Smart.
And so he made a little bit of money. Then the thing crashed back down. I don't know where it's at right now, but nope, I didn't. Did you dive into that one?
I did not, but your friend's decision obviously involves some intelligent design, at least regarding his stock choices there. Okay, that's good.
Some piece of sugar chemical in his body prompted him to do this,
Yeah, so, it wasn't.
But, seriously, Doug.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is not ribose, which is the sugar used in RNA, and it's not deoxyribose, the sugar used in DNA. The molecule is, again, erythrulose. And again, please, audience, I'd love to hear what you think of my pronunciation.
I'm not even going to take, I'm not going to touch it, Fred. I'm not going to touch that word. It's too difficult. Yeah, I have to give you a hat tip and a salute for even attempting to pronounce that word. Yeah.
Yep.
We'll include the word in the description so that you all can take a shot at it. See how you can do with it.
So this science report says that researchers think that molecules like this might participate in additional reactions that could eventually produce other biologically relevant compounds.
Well, sure. So what they found was not the sugar in DNA. They found a sugar that might react with other chemicals under the right conditions, like, say, the direction of a creator or a baker, and possibly become part of a longer chemical pathway.
Yeah. And, it'd be great to have Dr. Royal Truman on. We'll have to get a hold of him. Great friend of Real Science Radio. Because there's nothing wrong with studying, these chemical reactions. That's legitimate chemistry. The problem is when this chemical possibility gets quietly and subtly promoted into a story about how life came about on Earth,
uh-huh.
the lengths
yeah,
that
yeah. Yeah, we found molecule A, which might react with molecule B, which might produce molecule C, and therefore your great 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 grandfather was a rock.
Yeah, that's it. I guess that's the textbook version condensed pretty well there, Doug. So
yes. Well, Fred, I know I should have paid more attention in biology or was it geology? I should have paid better attention, I'm sure.
Yeah. So, by the way, this isn't evidence for the hydroplate theory. We want to make that clear because hydroplate theory that proposes that, you know, the material we're finding in space, like asteroids, meteorites, and comets, they're all within our solar system. They came from Earth during the violent eruption, the global flood that's, well, you know, that's documented in something, a book called The Bible. We highly encourage you to read it because whenever it touches on science, Doug, it's always accurate.
Amen.
So, but instead, this sugar was detected in a distant interstellar cloud near the center of the Milky Way. So,
right. So we should not say that the fountains of the Great Deep launched self-tanning lotion 26,000 light years into space. That would be a stretch, right?
Yeah. Yep. So
Real I'll Science cross Radio. Hold on, Fred. I'll cross that off the list of potential show titles.
Okay. So, Doug, our Real Science Radio takeaway in all of this is very simple. Yeah, it's kind of a fascinating chemistry discovery, but it's not life, it's not DNA, it's not evidence that life arose spontaneously like they somehow want to convince their audience that it was. It just provides another reminder that finding organic ingredients is easy, real easy, compared to explaining the information and machinery of life, which is vastly more complex and clearly designed.
Absolutely. And not only that, clearly designed by the God of the Bible, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. I appreciate you making that reference. I always like to point people back to the reliable source. But hey, if anybody comes back from the center of the Milky Way and they look a little chunky, maybe they got a sunburn. Now we know why. Because it's all of that unpronounceable sugar out there.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, we've got our Knucklehead Science Award of the Week, and that one's definitely deserving, very much so. There were a couple other stories, Doug, that I was hoping we'd get to, but we're getting close to running out of time. One of them was that scientists squished microbes into a steel sandwich and made a profound discovery about life in space. I mean, they're trying to show how, okay, an asteroid hits a planet, it squishes some microbes, and the microbes can survive and somehow make it to another planet. And so then eventually it's panspermia, which means you seed life from other planets on Earth. Incredibly ridiculous. I can't believe they say that with a straight face, Doug.
I know. Well, that's why this story and the previous story, well, at least the headline writers, were competing for the Knucklehead Science Award of the Week. But unfortunately, we only have so much time. We can only make so many Knucklehead Science Awards. Fred, there's probably not enough to go around. We can't make them fast enough for all the knuckleheads out there. But it's been great to be with you again, Fred, and with all of you watching. Help us out if you want to keep us on the air. Check us out on YouTube. And Fred, we'll have more Knucklehead Science. So while we're not on the air, that's what we're doing. We're constantly making Knucklehead Science Award of the Week, trying to keep up. And we'll do our best.
Yeah, and if you want to submit your favorite Knucklehead Science Story of the Week, please submit it to Real Science Radio at fred@rsr.org or doug@rsr.org or however you want to get a hold of us, leaving comments in the videos, however you want to do it. I mean, there was another candidate, Doug. This science article was titled, "Your Fingers May Hold a Secret of Human Brain Evolution." I mean, that one is off the chart, silly. That one just came out on July 17th, so somehow, yeah. Anyways, okay. Love to get into that at some point. We were out of time, Doug, but it was great having you on board again. And we will be back next week with another great episode of Real Science Radio. We thank all our listeners out there. And please, again, go to the store, store.rsr.org. And please buy our materials. That helps us stay on the air. Leave a donation. Sponsor one of our interesting facts of the week. It really helps us out. So for my co-host, Doug McBurney, I'm Fred Williams of Real Science Radio. May God bless you.